The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 335, film strip noir, Death in the 1970s Church Education Film, with Brian Waterman, Joanna Brooks, and Stacy Burton.
Okay, we will start this session on Death in the 1970s Church Films. Just wait till you hear the... I wonder if we'll watch the beginning of Cypher in the Snow. There's all that scary music coming up. The guy's riding in the bus behind the guy's riding in his car behind the school bus. The little kid taps on his shoulder. Mister, I don't feel very well. I've got to get off the bus. He steps off the bus. He's dead. So, I'm Brian Waterman. I'll moderate this panel. My co-panelists are Joanna Brooks, who's a PhD candidate in English at UCLA, who does work on just about everything, but her dissertation work is on early American conversion narratives. Yeah. Is that fair? Yeah. Early American conversion narratives. And Stacy Burton, who is an associate professor of English at UN Reno, does work on modernist writing, predominantly Faulkner, right? Or no? Is that your dissertation? Her dissertation was on Faulkner. Predominantly on what?
20th century narrative and literary theory.
That's exactly right. 20th century narrative and literary theory. So we're approaching these films as critics, and the tricky part of this task is that we're also approaching them to some degree as people who were shaped by these films. Joanna and I more than Stacy, as we've talked about this, but I know that for myself, as I watch these films, sometimes for the first time in 10 or 15 years, I realized, especially with a couple of the films, that I'll Build You a Rainbow, the way that they talk about the mother and what a mother is and everything, those kind of narratives really inform the way I think about my own mother. And on Cypher in the Snow, that teacher at the end who resolves he will never let another student be a loser, then that reminds me of my dad. The whole time I was growing up, my dad taught elementary and high school special education classes, and he's very committed to the same kind of program. And so I realized that I have a lot of my own emotions wrapped up, and that made me want to present some sort of a disclaimer at the beginning, because that may be the same situation for some of you. I don't think that what we're doing is trying to say that there's not something valuable being put across, or that maybe the principles that the makers of the films were trying to put across are in some way inherently flawed. Cypher has basically a decent message, don't ignore people and treat them like they're not humans. And even I'll Build You a Rainbow, a lot of people are invested in the idea of, families being together forever. So those aren't the things that we're trying to get at. We're more interested in talking about the ways that these messages are being conveyed. And I think that that's fair. And so I hope that in the process, if we seem a little bit jaded in the approach we're taking, it's at least for me, I'm having to force myself to take a critical distance. My brother-in-law, who is one of the most cynical people on the face of the earth, says that he can't watch I'll Build You a Rainbow without bursting out in tears at the end. So if any of you feel these conflicting emotions, if you feel these conflicting emotions, you're probably not alone. I'm just going to talk for a couple minutes about the way I'm approaching these movies, and the especially the element of death and guilt, and the ways that the films work to evoke emotion in the audience. And then I'll let Joanna and Stacy each take a couple minutes. And then I think when we're done kind of giving our basic approaches, we'll watch some clips from the films and then have more intensive and interactive discussions of, the actual portions of the films that we're able to watch. I'm approaching these films as someone who studies 19th century sentimentalist literature, and that's I study men and women authors, and mostly look at the ways that these people were trying to evoke responses from their audience. And in 19th century sentimental literature, the most famous example would be Uncle Tom's Cabin. I don't know, a lot of people had to read something like that while they were growing up. In these genres in the 19th century, the most common things you could run across in those pages are dead babies or dead mothers. I sometimes joke that or dead little girls, or little girls with consumption who die slowly, 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 and then by the time they finally die, you know, the tears are all over the page, and that's exactly what the authors wanted to do. They thought of literature as a way to evoke your sympathies. And they meant it more than we talk about, you know, a Hallmark card. They meant it more literally. If they could get you to have a bodily response, to cry, to have something happen within your body, then they've affected your nerves. If they can affect your nerves, they can control your bodies. They can control your emotions and your actions. Harriet Beecher Stowe has no qualms in saying that the aim of her novel is to work the audience into her political and religious program. She wants them to oppose slavery, and she does it by sensitizing their emotions, working them up, and then she and once people are crying and once people have their nerves affected, then she can lead them into the right way to go. Over the last couple of years, I've come to appreciate the views of a couple different authors who talk about the ways that this sentimental culture in the 19th century has affected or has grown into the culture that we live in right now. One of these authors, who is now we're a little bit past her, and she's a little bit old-fashioned, but I think that her book is still quite important, is Anne Douglas. Her book's called The Feminization of American Culture. I'm going to read a little paragraph from the introduction to her book, which kind of describes the interaction between text and audience that I think persists all the way into these types of films. She's saying that clergymen in the Northeast and female authors of sentimental literature work this way. I think that a limitation of her argument is that it's not broad enough. I think a lot of men in the 19th century who weren't clergy used the same strategies. But she writes, Northeastern clergymen and middle-class literary women lacked power of any crudely tangible kind, and they were careful not to lay claim to it. Instead, they wished to exert influence, which is a word that shows up over and over in the 19th century, which they eulogized as a religious force. They were asking for nothing more than offhand attention, and not even much of that. Influence was to be discreetly omnipresent and omnipotent. This influence rhetoric persisted into things like Fascinating Womanhood. If you think of those kind of women's handbooks of the late 60s, they talk about women exercising influence while men exercise power, and that's sort of how this has persisted too. Influence was to be discreetly omnipresent and omnipotent. This was the suasion of moral and psychic nurture, and it had a good deal less to do with the faith of the past and a good deal more to do with the advertising industry of the future than its proponents would have liked to believe. They exerted their influence chiefly through literature, which was just in the process of becoming a mass medium. The press offered them a chance they were seeking to be unobtrusive and everywhere at the same time. They inevitably confused theology with religiosity, religiosity with literature, and literature with self-justification. They understandably attempted to stabilize and advertise in their work the values that cast their recessive position in the most favorable light. Even as they took full advantage of the new commercial possibilities technological revolutions in printing had made possible, they exercised an enormously conservative influence on their society. So, on one hand, the reformers of the 19th century who used literature to work people's sympathies up, they were involved in some radical programs, the abolition of slavery, for example. But they were also evangelical Christians who were interested in creating a national program for everyone in the country to follow. You know, they wanted people to live the way they lived. Other authors have used similar ideas to Douglass's to explain how sentimental culture has persisted into the 20th century. I actually took a look at this today, and it seems a little bit too dense. This is Jackson Lear's book, No Place of Grace, which I think is a terrific book about later in the 19th century, but I couldn't find anything there that seemed really accessible. But one that I would recommend if you're interested in this idea is a book by Lawrence Moore called Selling God. And he includes actually sections on 19th century Mormons. But Moore's idea is that religions at the end of the 19th century used or had dialogue with secular culture and appropriated a lot of secular culture in order to keep their membership together. For example, if the Protestant churches were saying you couldn't dance, they're going to lose their members. So what they do instead is like the Mormon stake dance idea. They take over the entertainment industry, and so they can control it and keep it within their limits and also kind of keep their adherence behavior in check. And I think that this idea of religions borrowing from secular culture forms of entertainment in order to reinforce religiosity is what church film is all about. They give us an entertainment medium, and they also use the same sentimental forms that have persisted from the 19th century. Dead mothers, dead babies. In a book of Lydia Sigourney poems, she was the most widely read poet, except for maybe Longfellow in 19th century America. And in a book of her poems, there are more dead babies than on an episode of ER. I promise. But that also says something about ER, and it says something about our entertainment industry and our advertising industry, which still relies on sentimental manipulation of our emotions to get us to buy their product. And I think that when I was watching these, I was thinking, that's really what's happening. If you use the film I Build You a Rainbow in a proselyting situation, which I think it was used in most often, there's not doctrinal content. I mean, the families are forever bit is kind of in the background. That it's like the punchline. The real idea behind this film is let's get these people to cry, and when they cry, they're ready to buy. And that's that sounds a little bit jaded, but and I'm not saying that anyone consciously had this agenda, but it works. I mean, if you can get people in an emotionally vulnerable situation, you can probably get them to buy what you're selling. I have a couple more things, and then I'll turn it over to these guys. Actually, just one more thing I'll finish with. The more that I've read the sentimental literature of the 19th century, the more I've come to think of it as a very condescending type of program. That the for the most part, the evangelicals or maybe the middle-class liberal culture that wrote sentimental literature believed that they were in a superior position to everyone else. They were morally superior, and they could in turn condescend to help you up to their level by working on your sympathies and your emotions. And I think there's a little bit of that at work here, too. I think that these films ultimately are quite condescending. It's sort of like whoever is behind these are reaching out to raise you up to our understanding. And what this strikes up against for me is the way that these films somehow cheapen the complexity of human experience. So they're presenting themselves as morally superior, but they're really just giving you very easy formulas to live your life by. And this was really brought home to me last week when I went to see a film that's in theaters now, sort of small theaters or art theaters, called Ponette. Has anyone seen that? It's a French film about a four-year-old girl whose mother dies in a car accident. The girl's in the same accident. It begins in the hospital, and she is recovering, and her dad informs her that her mother has died, and she spends the rest of the movie, 2 hours, trying to come to terms with the fact that her mother has died, and from a four-year-old perspective. And it's incredibly well done. And for example, some of the things she goes through are that her At the funeral, her cousin tells her that unless her mom is buried in a certain way with a certain kind of pillow and certain kind of nails in the coffin, then she'll be locked in there forever, or she'll go to hell, and so these are the ideas that she's working with. You know, she's like, well, is my mom ever going to come back? And then she has some relatives who say, your mom's with Jesus, and then her dad is secular, and says, no, there's no such thing as Jesus, your mom is gone. And, about every 20 minutes, the little girl just starts crying because she misses her mother. And, one of the most stirring parts of this, well, two things that happen to her that are just really gut-wrenching, but in a very different kind of way than this. Her cousins also tell her that she can resurrect her mother by saying the magic words, Talita Kum. And so she goes out into a field by herself, and she stands out in the field, and she's supposed to clap when she says it. And so she stands there for like 4 or 5 minutes on the film, and it's just agonizing, and she just says, Talita Kum, and claps her hand, and she just wants her mother to come back so much. And then I watched I'll Build You a Rainbow. And I think you'll see what I mean from the clip, and I'll Build You a Rainbow. There is no grief. There's no mourning. The mother's dead on the bed. They cry for a couple minutes, and then the boy says, it's okay, families are forever. And that really cheapens the whole process of death and mourning and life and grieving, and the complexity of human experience reduces it all to this, you know, a little cross-stitch thing that's going to end up in DI, like Joanna said yesterday. The little cross-stitch thing that you hang on your wall. If you get a chance to see Ponette after you watch this, I think you would really appreciate it. These are some of the places that I'm starting from coming to these, and I'll let these guys talk about where they're coming from, and then we'll show some clips and talk about the individual films. So.
I appreciate Brian's really well thought out comments on sentimentalism, and I studied a slightly earlier period of sentimentalism, like the beginnings of it. And in the late 18th century, the difference seemed to be that you have these novels of transgression, and a young girl would make certain, she'd be seduced. These were all seduction novels. And
the coquette.
And so she would come and she'd be seduced by this, you know, guy who knew he was doing wrong, and she would die, see, but the guilty woman would die. And in the difference between this and church films, where little children are dying and being run over, is really an interesting thing we should probably tease out later. I just wanted to iterate that first after Brian's very smart comments on sentimentalism. We are not too far from our roots in sentimentalism, I don't think, as a church culture. I have many specific issues, and some of these I will table for the more open panel discussion, especially just the gender issues. They are writ large all over these movies. The people who are dying are women, except for their little kids. Cipher in the Snow, my favorite, is when, okay, the child is being buried, the grieving mother is standing at the graveside, and the junior high teacher who's going to make a difference walks away and elects to assist another 13-year-old kind of Cipher-looking kid while the grieving mother stands alone in the snow. She'll return to her abusive Olympia beer-drinking husband later that night, and no one seems to care. There's going to be no intervention on her behalf. It's just the next cliff that comes along. See, so there's just so many interesting gender things. We will, I'm sure, take those up as a group. What I wanted to focus most of my comments on, just to begin with, is the scope and the parable-like quality of these 1970s church films. I was struck, actually one of the reasons I wanted to do something on 1970s church films was the great difference in the films that are now being produced between what we used to see. I mean, you have kind of, you know, Called to Serve and Labor of Love, and these are epic, you know, lots of little shots of different people, you know, missionaries in this country, missionaries in that country, very brief. They're passing by a national landmark or over a great vista. You see them in profile. There's a person of color, because we have a few of those, just a few. And there's someone in a Spanish word, and then we have, you know, a Samoan or a Tongan brother or sister. You know, so we have our diversity shot. We have these brief, high-intensity, very diffuse, lighted, very small parables. Well, someone will stop in and have a change of heart and move on. But what really struck me in comparison to these grand scope, very short, very targeted, I think the purpose of the movies we see now is very well specified, is these films, which were set, most of them in small towns, supposedly in Utah. They stayed in one place the whole time. You saw the lives of people around you, almost as if you're a neighbor, you know, spying in on him. And you saw the bad parts, too. There's a movie that wasn't shown this morning that when I bought my tape compilation with Cypher and other things on it, Uncle Ben. Does anyone remember Uncle Ben? It was a short film about an alcoholic uncle who has to quickly reform himself after his sister dies, of course, take care of her three children. She's working, and I'm so tired. Next morning, she doesn't wake up. And the kids, oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, and the night before she goes to sleep, they sing, "Now the day is over, now the day," you know, and the next, when she dies, and then the ambulance comes, they have that weird sound, that boom, that's supposed to be tragedy, and then there's like this weird warped version of "Now the day is over," the no, that place where they're taking, we don't know why she dies.
You never know why they die.
No, I mean, you just don't get an asthma attack in a Reed Smoot movie because you're gone. It's over. But I mean, the real, you know, and I, you know, and I brought jaded eyes to these things because, you know, I hate being made to feel guilty with the mailbox, etc. But I was stunned with Uncle Ben, because here it is, you know, you see an alcoholic man losing his job, you see him walking to the bar in town, right? We're not talking about Metropolis where there are a million different pleasure palaces. There's one bar, and everyone knows who goes there in a small town. See, and there's this quality of your neighbors are visible to you. You know who the town drunk is, and you know they're from a Mormon family, and you know their uncle was a drunk, and et cetera, et cetera. And so in this movie, here's Uncle Ben. It shows him pressuring his sister for money. I mean, real graphic, just the desperate behavior of addicts. And then he turns his life around after the mother dies. The judge, who looks like, I think he's the same actor who played Lorenzo Snow in The Windows of Heaven. I recognize the voice. I'm like... But he says, you have 1 month to turn your life around. So Ben sits down with the bottle, with a bottle. See, and you see an Olympia beer can in Cypher in the Snow. You see these details, okay? He says, you have a month to turn your life around. And Uncle Ben says, I'll try. So he sits down with his bottle and says, it's either you or the kids, and it's the kids. And you don't see him sweating out recovery. You know, you see the daughter graduating from BYU some 20-odd years down the line. But I was struck by its openness, really. I was struck by the small town, almost parable quality, the fact that it could be visible in a film produced by the church that people have issues. That these are also people in our town, recognizable characters, for whom redemption is plausible. Now, this is a different movie than some of the others, but you see in Cypher in the Snow the same kind of... That's more of a blame film. The father of the child who dies is drinking his Olympia beer, you know, their stepfather, right?
Divorce is big.
Divorce is big. See, but these are, the class issues loom large here, too. These are poorer people. It's automatically identifiable. Okay. So there's this small town parable quality to them. And that's really interesting for me. And I wonder about church growth in the 1970s. You know, the weirdness factor, right? We were moving away from our weirdness factor, beginning to, especially after the revelation about the priesthood and African Americans. Okay. And what kind of function did these movies serve to help remind us of our weirdness roots? You know, or to kind of reground us in a local folklore, or in the idea of neighbors who look on each other and see all the problems. You know, most of us weren't living in Utah when we saw these films, I don't think. I mean, the church was, you know, by the late 70s, taking strides towards what it is now becoming. How would these films show now? I mean, those with foreign mission experience probably speak to this better than I could, but the scope and the epic scope of movies the church puts out, I think, really reflects some changes. But I can't say that I really like the new version all the much better if our view of the problem solving and the drama of human life is, as Brian points out rightly, cheapened in some of these movies. What about the absolutely truncated, you know, 20-second sound bites of "we had a dead baby, now we're better," "called to serve," "oh, there and here and here and here and here and here and everywhere, and everyone's happy, we are not weird" message of the new movies. So I'm just really curious, you know, these raise questions for me of use. Who were these movies shown to and why and where? Cypher in the Snow at least had an overt pedagogical, you know, use. It was shown to teachers as part of this teaching series. Where were the other ones designed to be shown? Were they designed to be shown, you know, most of the time we end up watching as entertainment. You know, we didn't want to have our Sunday school class, so we cheered because the teacher brought in, you know, the movie instead. You know, but, you know, you end up assimilating the messages nonetheless. Were they meant to be shown to bishoprics or high councils? Would the same messages have been sent? Who needed to see? Who needed to look in on their neighbors? You know, who needed the reality check, you know, the visual reality check? And I don't think it ended up with the people in positions of priesthood power. I don't think they were the ones who were watching these movies, most of all. Which brings me to one final reflection. The night after I watched Cypher, I took out the case reports of the Mormon Alliance because it reminded me an awful lot of, you know, and there we have volumes of Cypher stories, basically. They're most, you know, a lot of them are young women, and they're, you know, abuses of a sexual nature. You know, and I thought, you know, these are some ways, really, they reminded me of each other. Totally different. One being very documentary and serious, the other being very sentimental. But, you know, and you think about Cypher in the Snow, and you think about the contention of the Mormon Alliance, which is that with a certain power structure in place, these abuses basically are not aberrant. I mean, this is how I've read it. They're not aberrant. They are extreme forms of, you know, power structures already in place, which, you know, encourage or endorse or are complicit with the silencing of women or, you know, various practices of power which can go unchecked. That's my reading of it. And you think about the teacher leaving Cypher in the Snow graveside and says, no matter that my school principal is a self, right, you know, pompous, going to his board meeting, doesn't care, I personally will make a difference in the life of one child. And, you know, that it would endure, you know, the call for structural change that is made by people like, you know, Levina and Janice with the Mormon Alliance, and then the kind of clip, here you go, feel good, do something good for somebody else. It's just an interesting contrast. You know, one at a time, okay, we can do that, but the mother stands by the grave, still going to go back to her abusive family. The school district will probably not remain, you know, change in any way, become more attentive to the needs of, we call them at-risk students now. So, you know, again, what is the purpose of a film? And what is the purpose of a sentimental film that in which tragedy is displayed in a very visible way? I think there is a degree of familiarity here that I'm tremendously attracted to. When the church was a small town and we knew we were weird and we knew there were drunks, we knew there were people who drank coffee, and somehow it was all still ours. You know, we don't just have to claim the good moments. We can claim a lot of stuff. But then again, the tension of what is the point of this, you know, parable telling? Who is it aimed at? Where are the messages going? And do the messages we are left with, you know, will they ever lead to the point where there won't be another Cypher, you know, again? So that's my questions and thoughts. Thank you.
I have three things I want to talk about in kind of introduction. The first is whether critical thinking is normal or whether it's just nitpicking. I mention this because I have many students who think it's nitpicking. They come to my classes, they're English majors, and they come because they love books. And they say, well, do we really have to do this analysis stuff? And I point out that if they major in biology, they might do it because they loved animals, but they would still dissect them. And I would say the same thing about literature. And I do think critical thinking is normal. On the other hand, you have people up here who do that for a living or for a less than minimum wage living. And you have people up here who have thought this way for so long that for them it is normal, but it is not quite the same for everyone. And I often in my literary theory courses tell students about an experience I had when I was watching a television program called The Wonder Years, an episode of The Wonder Years, with family members who are a CPA and a dentist. An orthodontist, CPA and an orthodontist. And we were watching this episode. I was visiting them. We were sitting down. We watched it. And it ended with an unbelievably contrived ending to save the hero of the series from embarrassment, dealing with the consequences of his action, social trauma, etc. Kind of deus ex machina, friend shows up and solves all of his problems. And I said, well, that was a really lousy ending. It absolved, you know, I said just what I've just said about it. And the CPA and the orthodontist looked at me as though there were something wrong with me and said, can't you just watch this? What is the problem? You know, really, as though I had performed some sort of cruel response to the film. And then the CPA and I got in the car and went driving on errands. And about 15 minutes later, she said, Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I forgot. Thinking like that is normal for you. And we went on and laughed and talked about that. And her point was not that one way of viewing was normal and one was abnormal, but that in her world, looking at something and doing analysis of it required a different kind of effort and was a kind of nitpicking, obnoxious performance. In my world, it's the only, when you see things, they hit you in the face. You can't not see things critically. You can't not analyze them. And so she said, oh, I forgot, it's okay, because she was saying, you weren't trying to be obnoxious, you just think that way normally. So, is critical thinking normal? Yes, it is. And the CPA has learned. Okay, second point. Educational films. Is that a contradiction in terms? I want to talk very briefly about educational films. For me, one of the problems with the film, the three films we're looking at, is that they want to make an educational point, but rather than simply saying, here is the point, here is the dogma that I want you to learn, they use the form of narrative. They tell stories. Thus, you end up with this sort of very bad combination of indelible, overwrought images designed to traumatize you in a faith-promoting way, and a narrative, a story. The purpose of these videos is explicitly to simplify and to make containable and comprehensible things that are complex and incomprehensible. The bridge is about making the atonement understandable. I could just stop right there. It is about making it into something that is tragic, but really very simple. A father who chooses over an innocent child who is very small and very blonde, and over a trainload of people who are clearly not good Mormons, because they, you know, they're like wearing sunglasses on a train with sleeveless shirts and mustaches. So you can just kind of tell. But it takes the atonement and it simplifies it. It reduces it down to these images. I mean, who's not going to feel bad if a small, very blonde child is smashed by a train? What does that have to do with the atonement? Okay. Families Are Forever makes death resolvable through slogans and bad popular music. And again, and Brian's talked about this, the trauma is done as soon as you know the slogan. Ciphers in the Snow, as Joanna has talked about, makes complicated social phenomena reducible to errors of omission. If I had been nice, if I had thought about this person, and doesn't... What? If I had spent more time with my son, right. Okay, so those are the indelible overwrought images. Well, why not just go for that? And I come back to that contrast between the images and the narratives. Three reasons why I think they're not worth... why I find them problematic, why as a teacher I wouldn't use these films. The first is that they're so forced. I was, I think, overcome with sick delight would probably be the best description. When I went to the Mormon store in Reno and picked up The Bridge and found that it came with a 2-page guide, user's guide. This is a 10-minute film. The 2-page single-spaced guide, one side tells you how to prepare the viewers, how to introduce it, how to apply it, how to follow it up, and how to ask difficult questions, which are rigged so they're not difficult. The second page lists 26 parallels between the film and the Bible. I'll talk a little bit about these parables when we show part of The Bridge, but if you think about it, it's a 10-minute film. There are 26 parallels. That's 2.6 parallels per minute. You know, how much is going to be there? So it's forced, okay? It's force-fitted. The other point which Brian and Joanna have talked about, Brian especially in talking about sentimentalism, is they're very manipulative. Joanna came up with the title film noir. These points are all made by having someone die abruptly, often without explanation, dying so that you can't forget the movie. The same points could be made in other kinds of ways, perhaps. They are forced. They are implausible. David Lodge, who is a British writer and critic, in talking about how symbolism works, because these are, especially The Bridge, intended to be symbolic, says that literary symbolism tries to be original and tends toward a rich plurality, even ambiguity of meaning. all qualities that would be undesirable in traffic signs and religious icons, especially the former. He goes on then to say that a novelist, someone who is telling a narrative, telling a good story, should make a spade before he makes it a symbol. And it would seem to be a good advice for a writer who is aiming to create anything like the illusion of life. If the spade is introduced all too obviously just for the sake of its symbolic meaning, it will tend to undermine the credibility of the narrative as human action. And I think the humanity of the people in these films gets lost because they aren't humans first and symbols later. They're symbols who never quite have a full humanity. The third point I wanted to make about why not, why I thought I find these a pain, is that they are so reductive. Life isn't that resolvable. The death of a parent produces much more rage and sorrow and grief. Brian's made this point. It was telling to me that I was thinking about this at the time that I received an email message from a friend who had just found out his father was dying. And that message was full of rage and grief, and there were no three-word slogans that solved how he fell. It isn't just that they don't raise complex questions. I can understand in a pedagogical setting that you can't expect one film to show the full complexity of things. But they cut off complex questions. They teach, I think, reductive thinking. They teach you to find quick solutions to complicated topics. One-shot fixes don't do it. As Kent Frogley pointed out years ago in a humorous piece he wrote about one of the all-time great Mormon films, Johnny Lingo. As he commented, as I grew older, certain questions started to plague me. Mm-hmm. I began to suspect that marriage wasn't the barrel of coconuts I had been led to believe. This caused me to wonder about the Lingos and how they were doing. What about Mahana herself? Did this one-shot dose of confidence really transform her life, as I'd always thought? Being well-connected, I began checking around and found out, not without a rather smug sense of satisfaction, that the Lingo's marriage, like so many, hadn't been all beer and Skittles. And he goes on to talk about the tragic future of Mahana and Johnny. Okay, but one-shot fixes don't do it, but that's what films teach that they do. One last quotation I'd like to mention with this comes from Anne Lamott in her book about writing, where she's talking to writers about how to convey a point. And she says that characters should be believable. This goes back to the point I made about these characters not being quite human. Lamott writes, "We want a sense that an important character is reliable. We want to believe that a character is not playing games or being coy or manipulative, but is telling the truth to the best of his or her ability. We do not wish to be crudely manipulated. Of course, we enter into a work of fiction to be manipulated, but in a pleasurable way. We want to be massaged by a masseur, not whapped by a carpet beater." These are carpet beaters, okay? The last point I want to make touches on something Joanna said, and it's about women's voices in these educational films, because part of the education they offer is that women don't really exactly have voices. These are all films from the 1970s. The female character in The Bridge has very few lines, and what she says basically is, "I think it's about time, the baby is due, and go get your father, the time has come." Families Are Forever, the mother's thoughts are voiced almost entirely by the male narrator. I had noticed that the other children disappear in the film. As we were watching them earlier today, my mom pointed out that it was because they're both daughters. And in Cypher in the Snow has two female characters. Joanna talked about the mother. There's also a secretary who seems remarkably unastute. Her main function seems to offer sounds so that the character who's undergoing enlightenment is supposedly conversing with her. He'll say, "I realize this," and she'll say, "Oh?" And then he says, "This is what I learned." "Really?" And that's kind of the amount of depth. So those are the introductory observations I wanted to make, and I'll hand it back to Brian.
Which one would you Okay. I'm going to show The Bridge, and as we go through it, Stacy will point out some of the 26 parallels. I should mention that this was the one that I have the earliest memory of. And it was in a sacrament meeting. They turned off the lights in the chapel and projected this film onto the big blank white wall behind the pulpit. That's the first time I remember watching this. And I remember being horrified by it the same way I was horrified by family home evening lessons, where your parents are asked to gather you all around and they say, "What would we do if God told Daddy to take Brian and take him out on a mountain and kill him?"
That's me crying. I can't
remember the name.
Okay. Because this has 2.6 parallels per minute, let me start as the film is starting. Numbers 1 and 2 are that the story is about a father and his firstborn only begotten son. You will find that the name of the son is David, which means beloved. And that bridge, though I can't see it, is somewhat similar to the shape of a cross.
Which is a way to market this film to broader Christian audiences.
Oh, I'm getting way behind here, just a sec. The father and the son are one. The son is on the father's shoulders.
Is it too loud in comparison?
They work with the young calf and other animals. There is a division of light and shadow as they walk.
Think Genesis.
In the breakfast scene, the point is made that today the father will teach the son to plant his own garden. Oh, here we're back to the father and son are one, son on father's shoulders. They work with a young calf and other animals. This lists the scriptural parallels, but I'll leave those out. If you want verses, I'll tell you later. They work with plants. Although they work with plants is Genesis 1:11. Brian wanted the verse. They also work with primitive machinery, although this is the 70s. That's not a scriptural parallel. I was just kind of moved to say that. After the creation, chores, they rest, as on the seventh day of creation. Their images appear in the water, and the son is in the image of the father. The son does only that which he sees the father do. Right.
He goes, "Plant my garden."
He doesn't have a watch. He tells time by looking at the sun.
So that the people on the train can get across safely. You finish up here and go help your mother, okay?
The father must leave the sun, and the son must complete his work in the garden.
These are the worldly people with their sleeveless shirts.
Yes. Oh, yes, the people on the train are of the world. That's parallel 19. No reference for that one. Mm. The bridge upon which the sun dies is somewhat in the shape of the cross, high in the center with a pedestal and wide wings to each side. The last time we see the sun before the sacrifice, he is on his knees in the garden. The bridge and what will happen on it is the bridge between death and life, mortality and immortality. That's from Corinthians and Revelation. Symbolism's like that. Pretty boring, yeah. Yes. That's another biblical parallel, definitely, yes. Long, boring passages. Yeah. This is like 2 Nephi, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, 2 Nephi. I don't know. I don't know on that. On some of them, there are writer credits, and on others, there aren't. This one has a writer credit at the beginning. You can see he's having trouble with the bridge. As the people of the world are hurtling toward the bridge, one of the parallels coming up, or maybe we're there now, I can't tell, is because the cross was in place, the people of the world are able to continue along the track of life and are not lost.
Suspense music of the 70s.
He's real strong, yeah. Probably the father's act benefited everyone on the train.
Daddy,
people of the world did not know what was done for them. And the son was not only sacrificed for the people of the world, but also for the unborn, because his mother's pregnant. That's why he went to the bridge. The guide suggests that it is effective at the conclusion of the film to ask viewers to quote the scripture that most nearly tells them what the film symbolizes. Anything? Is that John 3:16? Yeah. Ooh, you got it right. Okay, someone almost always volunteers John 3:16. Most viewers will then agree the film is about the atonement. Next, ask if anyone saw more parallels to the Bible. You may have to give a hint or two, such as, what about the shape of the bridge upon which the son was sacrificed? Or what did they do in the beginning of the film after which they rested? They will usually be able to give more parallels. We suggest you not introduce all of the parallels. Oops. And then it goes on to ask the kind of question that Brian was talking about. What if the people were on the train were really bad? What if they had broken all of the commandments, et cetera, et cetera? So that's kind of what the study guide is all about.
Would it have made a difference if the people on the train were really good?
Or would it have made a difference if the conductor had been the mother, or the train switch operator had been the mother? Could a mother have possibly pulled that bar down in the paradigm that this film operates in? She would have jumped up and let the train smash herself,
she probably would have smashed herself, and then the train would have stopped,
and then the boy, it would have screeched to a halt right before the boy got there.
That's right. She's home pregnant.
She's having babies. She's busy.
There's just one important thing, because we'll talk about this later, but I worked there then. And this was a story that had been around for a long time and continually came to BYU. This was not produced by the church.
Right.
This was a private BYU thing. Right. The questions, I mean, the church members loved it. No denying that.
Right.
We all bought into it. But this came up, and at least as far as the people I knew at BYU, it was just too morbid. It was too whatever. Yeah. And the church completely passed on it.
We knew that, and it's marketed by a private company that doesn't use any church name, and it's marketed to broader Christian audiences. That's why all of the parallels are from the Bible, and why they talk about the bridge being a shape of a cross, which isn't a normal Mormon illustration to have the gulf and then have a cross. That's more of an evangelical Christian approach.
We have to keep in mind that the Book of Mormon is full of Trinity doctrine. So you have parallels right there in the Book of Mormon.
Sure, I'm not saying that they're not there. I'm saying that the reason they don't use it is because they're marketing it to as broad an audience as possible.
My husband said he saw it in an ethics class at his Catholic high school in Washington,
D.C. I think we had a question there, and then Jane.
And I saw it in sacrament meeting, so.
Jane.
Yeah.
Or that no one prepares the kids and no one gives them adequate information, you know. Yeah.
What kind of father who works around train tracks doesn't tell his kid not to go?
Don't ever tell your kid to run down the middle of a train.
Yeah, that points out that there's a lot of factual problems with the narrative and the way it's structured. I mean, there's no pressing need for the kid to go tell his dad. I mean, he's going to come right back after the train goes.
Well, unless the labor is really quick.
Yeah, the labor is so fast. But it has to be there for the story to be able to work. And that's one of the ways in which it's contrived. The garden is contrived. You look around them when they're planting it, they already have corn that's about 3.5 feet tall. It's obviously going to be like late July when they're planting this stuff. And they're not going to be able to harvest it before the winter comes. So. But that also brings up another one of scriptural parallels. Other worlds have I also created, other gardens have I already planted.
Go ahead. One behind you and then sigh.
Well, what intrigues me, I mean, Joanna said, doesn't this remind you of the atonement? Well, this says that the atonement is an accident gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, I was kidding.
That
Right. A tragic, tragic mistake.
I think it's interesting, too, that this was brought up on, some people were talking about this on email, and I had never seen this until I bought it a few days ago so that I could, you know, say something about it. But several people had seen this when they were relatively young or when they were growing up. Most of them had been appalled by it, the point that the gentleman made about it being too morbid. And virtually every person, I think, who commented said, what, you know, that it is this accident gone morbidly wrong, that there's no volition on the part of the son. The study guide actually anticipates this misreading. And says that some have said the film does not portray a true analogy to the sacrifice of Christ, since the boy did not knowingly give his life. However, this is the same type of symbol used throughout the Old Testament of the sacrifice of the lamb, which did not knowingly give its life. And I think that's an example of how the kind of reductive thinking I was talking about earlier works, that the human is not fleshed out as a human being at all, but is reduced to that kind of symbolic level.
We have a question here, a comment here, and then come back.
Comments already been made how morbid it is. I think it's appalling. It's so morbid.
So yeah. He looks on and just...
He watches. Yeah.
The broken body tossed in the track.
Yeah.
Following on the comments about an accident, I like that, because here the father was powerless to intervene in both situations, and that also goes against the traditional notion of God as all-powerful. Here the father could not fix them both.
I mean, what I see here in a lot of these movies is a series of very hard choices people make to cover up for their own... basically, the structure breaks down. The community breaks down somehow in most of these movies, right? There are children that are not taken care of. There are, you know, safety measures that aren't in place. Adequate education has not gone on. This kid, don't walk on the dang tracks when the train is coming, if the train's coming, jump in the water or something. Cipher in the snow, you know, the whole school structure is broken down. And yet the child dies, and it is for the good of the adult or the good of the viewing audience who didn't die. This is an acceptable sacrifice, and we promise to do better. But what really strikes me is that, you know, the message, I think, and it just came to me, if you missed guys watching these, is the message to me seems to be, when the community fails you, bow out. You bow out. There's not a change. See, you don't speak out. You don't lash out. You don't move out. You disappear when the community fails you. You see what I mean? That there will be people that the community fails, but they will kind of drop off the face of the earth. And I think that that's just that death positive kind of message. If if it doesn't fit, don't say it. Disappear is really, at least in my life, has been a big, huge, strong thing. So, moving on.
Well, go ahead and
there's one more comment.
Oh, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Could I just give a 2-minute historical context to the whole issue you're discussing? Or 1 minute?
Sure.
I just thought about this last night during the other thing, and I worked at BYU during the early 70s, and now I understand why I went straight from there. I wanted to be a great writer, but I went straight from there to advertising, so thank you for enlightening me. at that time, in the early 70s, I'll just relate one discussion. Did anybody ever take class from Reed Bradford? Anybody know Reed Bradford? He was a very gentle soul. He taught religion and child development classes and had a PhD from Harvard. And his whole concept was chicken soup for the soul. Your term paper was everybody would bring in their favorite chicken soup story and they'd circulate that to the whole class. And I remember a discussion, and he was pushing for these kind of films. And they asked him, Scott Whitaker, who's dead now, and him, I don't know where he is, and they said, well, how did Elder Packer like it? And he said, and Scott reported, do whatever you have to do, it didn't teach us a darn thing. And Reed Bradford was heartbroken because his whole concept was compassion and love and gentleness was the essence of the gospel, and the pressure from the brethren was teach doctrine, missionary work doctrine. So he saw these kind of films, you know, as embarrassing as they are now, as a great step forward in the church, that these compassionate, feel sorry for the student that dies on the train or whatever, was a great, great advance. And anyway, it's very interesting it's interesting to me anyway, that these movies that are so terrible, but they were seen as a step forward in the church. because it wasn't just doctrine, and it was actually teaching compassion and love, no matter how badly it was teaching it.
My question is, did people have to finally, and did people, at least in the movies, have to die before we could introduce the concept of compassion? You see what I mean?
Yeah,
why could there be a movie about a successful redemption, you know, where someone did not die, where it was not in drab tones and kind of, you know what I mean?
Like, well, the one I worked on was the Emmett Smith story, and he didn't die, he only had a brain tumor. And the crippled girl did walk at the end, so.
Okay.
But so there was a few, but I admit, very few. But I was thinking in the 70s, what you guys were talking about, reading The World According to Garp. And, you know, he'd introduce all these, and that was considered great literature, introduce all these cute little kids and then have them in a car accident, and the gear shift goes to their eyeball, and all the Larry McMurtry novels, everybody is cut up in 15 pieces. So I think it's not just 19th and 18th century, I think it's
1980s.
Yeah, sure. One thing, too, that Anne Douglas argues in The Feminization of American Culture is that in the middle of the 19th century, there was a doctrinal shift in the way Protestants understood God, and that God became domesticated and became anthropomorphized metaphorically, that God had emotions and feelings and would be sad if you didn't go to heaven and things like that. And I mean, so putting a you know, God in this kind, in that kind of a life, the bridge, it's the same thing, you know, it's you being able to relate to God's emotions, which is really kind of bizarre theological. Okay, this is a scene from Cypher in the Snow. The boy's already died, and the teacher has to go to the parents and tell the parents that the boy has died. And I think that we're showing this because Joanna wants to call attention to some of the class issues that are taking place in this film.
What did he die of?
He died because no one loved him. So
Brian,
he fell off a bus.
Brian, why don't you stop it for just a sec?
He ran off road.
For those of you who don't recall this and have had the fortune of never seeing it, this one starts with school kids waiting for a bus in the snow, one kid's apart, they get on the bus, he gets on, he doesn't talk to anyone, he's riding along on the bus, goes up and tells the bus driver, I don't feel good, I need to get off the bus. He stops the bus in traffic, the kid stumbles down the stairs and falls dead in the snow. The bus driver comes up, and there's heavy duty melodramatic music. It's very good.
No one does CPR.
Nobody does CPR.
This is a young child.
They're like, oh, he's dead.
Sorry, the ambulance hit there. Oh, I'm really sorry.
And this is actually good if you want to teach foreshadowing to like 3-year-olds. The music would be really good for that because it's such heavy-handed music. He falls dead. Conveniently, the car behind the bus is the school teacher who you see here, and they go up and they look. Look at the body, and the kids go, "Ooh, is he dead?" And then this is after he died.
Well, the ambulance guy tries like 4 hits with the CPR, and it's.
Do you know where the story came from?
Oh yes.
Oh, Roland Pearson adapted.
It was written by a woman in Idaho, and I don't know if she was Mormon or not.
No.
And it's a real story. It's reported as a real story that was published that was later
and
made into a film.
She won a national contest with it. Carolyn Pearson wrote the screenplay for this.
And again, Reed Bradford was the one who circulated this class, was pushing this to be made for years and years.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow, we've got to bring him into
the version of it
equation.
The instructor, was Maxine the instructor, the old,
right.
50s or early 60s?
And Reed Smith was also involved.
Yes, he was.
Yes, that's right.
Damn straight.
You have to notice when they show the father. Well, I'll point it out to you.
Turn up.
I'm sure he was. Can you complain? Never said nothing about anything since the day I moved in.
Okay. The voice markers of, you know.
I gave that boy everything I could, but he could just never catch on.
The ineffectual mother weeping in the background, abused and scared, probably.
This wasn't dumb. I'm sorry it was dead.
A paragon of sensitivity.
She's not. She doesn't have enough money for an apron.
Right. Well, and the father's not at work either.
We have that snow.
This is it.
Tongue.
Okay. Check that out. And you even see the brand.
Oh, you forgot. I tell you to go out and shovel those
He's watching it's boxing like on TV.
Basketball. Archie Bunker.
I forgot.
With a bad.
Where you been for 2 hours? Going for what? For 2 hours? Dummy.
See, I mean, the malnutrition dark circles.
Doing what?
Bacon.
Oh. What's that in your hand there?
It's a willow. Sorry, Betty's not in the spring yet.
A willow. I ask you to please go out and shovel the water. And you spend 2 hours thinking about willows. When are you going to start using that head of yours for something besides keeping your ears apart?
Yeah. The obesity, and I mean, constant drink, you know,
and
one drink after another.
He wasn't down.
I should have spent more time with him.
So you didn't? I'll let it be.
Okay. This angry white male. We had him picked out years ago.
Hey, where are you going?
To see my son.
What about my breakfast?
Okay. I mean, in the beginning, too, it struck me that when Cliff, you know, the child that is the cipher, is standing, waiting for the bus, he is standing apart. You can see the difference in the clothing. He's dressed inappropriately for winter somehow. He has on a short jean jacket rather than, you know, everyone else has big...
too high.
Yeah, everyone else has big woolly hats and, you know, mittens, and the girls all have shiny coats on. And you can tell in the clothing, you know, and you can tell in his thinness and his pale... And the class thing strikes out at me a bit, because one is redeemed from these broken, you know, wrong side of the tracks neighborhoods. It's interesting. But I wonder what transforms in the social structure of the family if it's suddenly moved on up to the east side. Yeah. I'm trying to think. Uncle Ben is definitely a class issue because, you know, the mother dies. I mean, she's working at a grocery store. The father has died long ago. She is the sole provider for the family. They're living in one of those small... West Side Provo town, you know, houses.
This is how sentimental literature works. This is a poem he wrote in the second grade that included in his school file. His hair is blonder. The raccoon egg.
It's morning in America.
I want to make a point about the statement on divorce in in here too. We go to the third grade teacher.
Oh, the teacher. Amazing.
Claire. What are you daydreaming about today? You always got your mind on something else. Claire. You've got to try harder. You know you're the slowest one in the class, and you want some help at school. Do you want me to have your parents in for a conference?
They won't come.
Why not?
They're getting a divorce.
People seem to live up to what other people think of them. Slow learners.
I mean, there's no intervention. You see, there's no... We don't see how people can respond to each other charitably or compassionately in difficult circumstances. It's kind of like, after we've really messed up, then we can look back on film and learn. And there's just one dead kid, you know.
I think, to me, that's one of the things that's interesting about this film is how the characters are very, very simplified, transformed very quickly. This teacher doesn't remember the kid at the beginning and at the end is overcome by the image of himself as the favorite teacher who should have done better. And as in other films we've seen, the things are just pushed to extremes. The stepfather is characterized, caricatured to an extreme. The mother is guilty. The principal is really proud of his hair. Right there.
They were given all the food and physical care they needed. Mortality rate.
He's a math teacher.
Well-fed babies turn their faces to the wall and die. When the doctors finally caught on, they prescribed, along with the food and blankets, a little attention, a little love. Cliff held on for a long time. Finally, he just turned his face to the wall, too. Turned his face to the wall and died, as he was a man. In a way, we all share the blame. What are we going to do about it? What can we do? Maybe a little attention, a little love.
The teacher's briefcase becomes the coffin.
Cipher in this picture?
It's long legs. I think it's kind of long legs.
Bad hunch.
Bad haircut.
Excuse me, are you Mr. Collier?
Yes, I am. Why?
Well, I was wondering if I could talk to you for a minute.
Look, son, I have a lot on my mind right now. Could we make it some other time?
Yeah.
She's still standing there.
My name is Leroy Jones, and I'm going to be in your math class next spring.
Later.
I was wondering if you could give me some help.
At that moment, I resolved never to forget Cliff Evans. He'll be my challenge from now on. Each September, as I look at the unfamiliar faces, I'll look for veiled eyes in an alien world. I've promised myself I may not do anything else for them. But not one of them is going to come out of my class a nobody. A zero.
Because now when there are 40 kids in my class, I can't change the lives individually of all the collective social ill that has been done to them over their short lives. Yeah.
You might be interested to know, I teach interpersonal communication. And the textbook that I'm using right now is by Adler and Town. It's in the 8th edition. So it's very recent. It includes the text of this story in the chapter on self-identity and the importance of messages that we receive when we're young to create our self-identity.
Do they have any pedagogical application? I mean, how do they apply that?
This textbook uses cartoons, it uses quotations, it uses stories and narratives interspersed throughout the theoretical text. So it doesn't come with any explanation in the textbook either. It's just stuck in the chapter. And students are supposed to construe for themselves some sort of integration between the narrative and the theoretical discussion of how our self-concept is created.
Right.
Socially.
There is vocabulary even around it to tell you what you're supposed to glean from that story, at least in the textbook.
That's correct.
Yeah. See, I think that's a helpful difference.
Well,
yeah.
Like I said, I mean, I don't think that on the largest level, a film like that is going to, you know, is hyper-destructive. I mean, it's saying be nice to people, and that, I can relate with the teacher and my dad and stuff like that. But I think it's what Joanna was saying, that there's no structural changes made. There's
Brian, what if you identify? What if you're watching this and you're 11 and you're miserable in your Sunday school class and you identify with Cliff?
I identify with Cliff.
Yeah, me too.
When he makes the snowman.
Well, and I identify with Cliff the whole way through. And what do you see? People remember you fondly. They finally learn something when you leave. You know, if you could show them. See, I mean, that's hard. I mean, that's real hard,
yeah.
Lesson. You know, that they'll learn from you if you show them. If you did, because they can't see right now. They don't talk to you. Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, it's harsh.
We need to play the last clip so we can at least get it in. This is the end of I'll Build You a Rainbow. What you've missed is the music, no text. What you have is the alarm clock rings, and the mother says it's time to have the baby. And so then the rest of the movie up to this point are snapshots of this baby's life, full of things that grab at my heart, like the little kid pouring milk into the cereal and for the kitties and spills it all over the floor, which my daughter did last week. And so those kinds of things, you know, are designed just to grab at people. But here's where the story of Jamie actually...
Another blonde child.
With brown-haired parents.
Mother's message to the sun, sung by a man.
With a band playing. They pointed out yesterday that in a Reed Smoot film, if they're short of breath, that means they're going to die. But in the film strip version, it's if you have glossy eyes, you're going to die.
Good.
So watch the mother for her glossy eyes.
In the dark circle.
Once there was a little boy named Jamie, and he had some great friends, but his greatest friend was his mom. Not in some sissy way or anything like that. While they were busy going to their fashion shows and bridge parties, she was home with him. They'd play in the backyard, go on bike rides, they'd have long talks. Why, she was the greatest football player on the whole block. Well, at least that's what the other guys said. You know, they thought she was really something. And they wished their moms could be more like that.
Where are the other two kids when she finds their glassy eyes.
She's fading. Fading.
Fast.
When you see sunlit plants, you know death approaches.
To his mom for a minute. And when he tiptoed into the bedroom and saw her lying on the bed, she smiled and said, "Hi, Big Jay." That's what she always called him, even though he really wasn't very big. She said he had a big heart. She said, "Jamie, I'm going away. And I won't be coming back. I'm dying." And big tears came into Jamie's eyes, and he said, "But Mom, you just can't die. Mom, you just can't." And she said, "It's okay. There's no regrets. Why, I've been with you more in 8 years than most moms have been with their boys in a whole lifetime."
They're too busy working.
No, they're going into fashion shows.
I know, but you just can't die. And she said, "Jamie, there's a secret. And it's a special secret. And I want you always to remember it. Families are forever."
"I'll build you a rainbow real high above."
There's no explanation.
What is she dying?
No one knows why she's dying.
He's been called home from school. There's an ambulance in the driveway while she's saying her parting words to her children in the bedroom. To die from an undiagnosed disease.
And she's all placid. You know, her white bed sheets are all halo effect around her. She has a little white dress on.
I think that she died because he went to school.
The daughters reappear for sympathy during the death scene, but they've been missing during the football scenes.
She closed her eyes and Jenny's dad broke down and started to cry. They held each other real tight. Jamie could feel his dad's teardrops on his own cheek, and he started to cry too. And then he remembered the secret, and he looked up and he said, "Dad, Dad, it's all right. Families are forever.
I'll build you a rainbow, a rainbow way up high above. Send down a sunbeam."
And notice the gender things that are going on here. The dad has cried. This fits along with David Norton's idea. Butter and Abrams, cooking. David Norton says that Mormon men are taught to be gentle, more gentle than the national culture.
Watching over my boy, I'll be happy in heaven. Watching over my boy.
Maybe she died in childbirth.
But before we talk about it, I just have to show you the advance of the next movie on the thing. You just have to read the thing that comes up before the movie starts.
If you are concerned about the continuing erosion taking place in the moral, physical, and spiritual fiber of our country, if you believe the family can be either the virus or the vaccine for future generations yet unborn,
the family,
we sincerely hope you'll consider what this next 30 minutes has to offer.
What year was this
produced? This was 1972. I only want to show one thing, that in all of these pictures, the glow in the middle of the screen, like that. In a couple of minutes, you'll see the token Lamanite family. It's really fun.
White skin flashes.
White shirt.
Gordon jumped, eh?
Well, once again on this one, this was produced by Universal Studios. I don't know if it says that. But the church was, again, trying to reach out to BYU and actually get some professional editing of things. Mm-hmm. So, again, they thought this was a real step forward because they actually paid a lot of money to Universal Studios to produce this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is included on Cross Lighting Video,
this one,
too.
Not the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
The one.
You notice
yeah.
He is the one we see on TV as the Maytag man.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't ask about what happened to his cover.
You know, that's the thing I was thinking about, that the real trick, I've just realized, in 19th century sentimental literature and 18th, too, was that you knew that the person who tried to, I mean, at least if they were male, the person who most actively tried to arouse, because they were all designated for female eyes, the guy who was male said, "Oh, listen to your feelings." He was bad. See, it was interesting. A woman could teach you listen to your feelings in these books, but he was usually, at least in 18th century, trying to seduce you. You know, listen to your feelings. Give in to your passions. It's like, don't go with that guy, which, of course, she did, and so she died because she was bad. See? So what do we have when we have all this, you know, sentiment, force-fed, you know? Okay, so this teacher, right, is going to make this huge difference. I'll do better. Like, already, you know, just comes home, takes off the mask, and has his own cipher in his own house. It's just the overt sentimentality is really, like, almost a tip-off. It's like, no, something bigger is not right here.
Well, it's not just bad movie making. It's manipulation. It's preserving of an image.
I think there's one more in the back.
For me, I think the message of the one we just saw is great. That was a turn on. That's a great message. But I think it's interesting, just as you have this expansive message, you sear these archetypes in the people's brains when they're at their most vulnerable. The best kind of family is where you have adults and little kids. The best kind of kid is a little blonde boy. The mom is a masculine mom who doesn't go to parties and do things like that, but plays football with her kids.
the best kind of death is what Ally McGraw died of in Love Story.
Yeah, yes.
Where you just get more beautiful.
That's consumption.
So that's what I think is a danger. I wish there was a way to express something in a short way, but also kind of leaves it open-ended and allows for more complexity.
Mm-hmm. So I say if you watch Ponette in the next couple of weeks, you will be just beat over the head by the difference in the way that death is approached.
At least one critic has said that the little girl should be nominated for an Oscar.
The little girl in Ponette won an award for Best Actress at Vienna Film Festival.
I think someone touched on it earlier, posed the question about what kind of audience they were trying to reach with these videos. I'd like, if anyone can clarify it, are these used by missionaries to convert people, or are these...
I'll Build You a Rainbow is on Proselyting Video 2, which was a proselyting video, but before that it was a film strip, and so missionaries and places where they still have film strips, I didn't in a domestic mission. We didn't have film strips. But I have friends who are my age who showed this all the time in South America.
Are showing these to adults? Or
yes.
Well, I mean, if you think about actually one of the church's new videos, one of the new real glossy ones, there is a family who's lost a child. And the grieving process is really glossy. I mean, there is at some time removed. The thing that's most